Hello and welcome to the Anonymous Anthropologist Podcast. I'm your host, the Anonymous Anthropologist. I am a community college professor of anthropology with more than 14 years of experience in the classroom, and today I'm here to teach you something. Hello and welcome back to the podcast. I am your host, the formerly Anonymous Anthropologist. I am L.W. Lucas Haston. You can find me online at lwhaston, that's haston.com, or you can find me at theanonymousanthropologist.com. Today, I am here to talk to you a little bit about Islam. With everything going on in the news in December 2015, with all the paranoia, with all of the high-pitched, insane rhetoric coming from Donald Trump about wanting to exclude Muslims from entering the country and all the craziness that's going on, I just wanted to talk to you guys a little bit, just a little bit, about what Islam really is. All right, so first let me give you the context. I was born and raised in New York City. I come from a secular Jewish family. We did not practice the religion really at all, except for the major holidays. And I was raised by folks who I would have to say were not religious. Maybe I'm not even sure if they really believed in God, to be honest with you. So I was really raised with a culture of assimilated Judaism, but not the religion. As an adult, until very recently, I identified as a masculine woman, a butch lesbian, and my regular listeners know that now I identify as a trans man. I'm transgendered. I came out a couple of podcasts ago, and now I do identify as a transgender man. And of course, this transition is going on in full view of my students, whom I see every day. They're totally aware of it. So when you bear in mind who I am to these students, that I am a secular Jew from New York City who identifies definitely as a member of what you might think of as a queer population. I'm definitely different than the hetero norm. These students nonetheless asked me, of all people, to be the advisor to the Muslim Student Association on campus at the community college where I am privileged to teach. So right away, that says something about them, their open-mindedness, their acceptance and love of me. They don't care that I am not Muslim. They don't care that I identified as a lesbian. They don't care that I now identify as transgendered. It doesn't matter to them in any way, shape, or form. They just appreciate the person that I am, my input, my point of view, and they asked me to be their advisor. I have served in this capacity for about 2 years now. At community colleges, clubs come and go as students move through and graduate. I have served previously as advisor to what we used to call the Mideast Awareness Club, which also had as its concerns what's going on in the Muslim and Arab world. So I have a fair amount of experience with Muslim students. I'm really honored that my Muslim students are so fond of me and have such great respect for me. I return that fondness and respect for them. So my perspective on Islam comes from my interaction, honestly, with my Muslim students over these past 14 years of teaching in a California community college. So the first thing that has to be said is they are wonderful, amazing people. There is nothing in my experience to show me otherwise. The people that I have been privileged to work with and know as Muslims, when they identify themselves to me, have been just like any other student, dedicated to their excellence in their studies, dedicated to moving their lives forward. And by and large, most of them are born and raised in the United States or came here as very young children and identify to a great degree with what we might think of as American values. Last year, a young woman I'll refer to as Khadija served as president, and this year her younger brother has stepped up to fulfill the role. These two young people come from a traditional Muslim family, although both were born and raised here in the United States. I think they were largely homeschooled until they came to community college, and their education and preparation has been outstanding. They are absolutely top students, A-plus students. Their knowledge base far exceeds the knowledge base of most of my public school educated students. They are impressive scholars. Khadija wears a head covering. She wears what is referred to as hijab. It is a simple black scarf that covers her hair and her neck, and her face is completely visible. She dresses modestly. She typically wears long sleeves, long skirts, and you really can't see her body at all except for her hands and her face. She wears no makeup. She defies so completely the American stereotype of the oppressed, veiled Muslim woman. It's unbelievable. I have never met such a strong, powerful, independent thinker as Khadija. She is unbelievable. There's nothing oppressed about her. She is strong-willed and well-spoken and incredibly intelligent and well-versed in her knowledge of her faith. One might think, according to the stereotype, that her brothers would have more status than her, that would have more to say than her, but this is definitely not the case. Her brothers show her great respect. She served as the president of the club before her brother did. This afternoon, the Muslim Student Association hosted a presentation given by another one of my students. The student, let's call her Sarah, did an independent study research project. It began as an ethnography, which is a study of a culture, and the culture that she studied was that of women on the campus of my college who wear hijab. Hijab is a style of modest dress. It can be anything from a simple headscarf to a full-body covering. After speaking one-on-one with several young women on campus, she then did some historical research to see if she could find some context for how the practice began and what it meant. And then later on, we worked together to build some theory into the project. She came and presented this to a meeting of the Muslim Student Association, whose numbers were significantly augmented by the presence of lots of my other students from other classes who were offered extra credit for their attendance. I think it was very worthwhile because I think they learned quite a lot today. So Sarah did her presentation, and she talked about what she learned from the young Muslim women on campus. She talked about the history of veiling. And then my students asked some really great questions, and we had just a terrific time. Then I got in my car, and I drove home, and I listened to the radio, and I heard Donald Trump propose that we exclude all Muslims from the United States, which is unbelievable. It is incredible. It is so against the Constitution. It is so against the ideals of America. It's just hard to believe that it gets any play at all. Nonetheless, there are hardcore radical people in this country, and he reflects their point of view. I hold out hope that this is a very small number of people overall, and that these crazy, horrible, racist policies will never be implemented at any level. So I felt that I should come home to my place here and sit down in front of my microphone and explain to you all a little bit about what Islam actually is before you all go into some kind of crazy panic and think that every Muslim is out to get you, because they are not. First of all, Islam is a religion of the book related directly to Judaism and Christianity. Forgive me if you already know this, but let's assume that maybe you're coming to this with no information at all. I'll start at the basics. The Jewish people were the first to write down a comprehensive theology that revolved around the worship of one God. He was called Yahweh. That's Y-A-H-W-E-H. In Hebrew, you say Hashem, because you're not supposed to speak the true name. The stories that the ancient Hebrews told about their origin in the desert were not recorded, were not written down until the period of their captivity by the Babylonians. When they were taken captive, these basically pastoral people were marched in through the gorgeous gates of Ishtar into this beautiful, spectacular city that must have been overwhelming. And they looked at each other and said, "Holy cow, we better write down our theology before we completely lose it inside this other culture." That is when the first five books of the Old Testament, or the Torah, were actually written. It makes complete sense when you look at the Old Testament to see a story about the ancient Hebrews who were enslaved in Egypt and eventually freed because their God took vengeance on the Egyptians. Well, that's a great thing to believe in when you are currently enslaved by the Babylonians. It gives you hope for the future. Let it be said that archaeology offers no definitive proof that the ancient Hebrews were ever enslaved in Egypt. That's a fact. It is also a fact that the pyramids of Egypt predate the actual existence of the Jews as a known group of people by thousands of years. Eventually, the descendants of the Jews enslaved in Babylon came to produce a man who would go on to be the prophet of Christianity. The life of Christ is detailed in the New Testament. The New Testament is based on the Old Testament. It takes as truth all of the stories of the Old Testament and builds upon them. There are some fundamentalist Christians who know more about the Old Testament than secular Jews like I do. They take it very seriously as part of the overall canon. Now, granted, the God of the Old Testament is kind of an angry, unlikable dude. He's just smiting everybody and killing everybody, and one can barely get through the story of the Exodus of the Jews without feeling awful for all the Egyptian boys who were killed. I mean, it's just a horrible, bloody, bloody story. That God is not a nice guy. The God of the New Testament is a whole lot friendlier. That God is all about peace and love, and if you get baptized, you can eat bacon. You know, it's a totally different situation. But we're dealing with the same God in both books, that same God, and the same descendants, Adam, Eve, Abraham. These are both Abrahamic religions because the patriarch, the original patriarch, is Abraham. Not very long after the Gospel of Christ was recorded, Muhammad was born. Muhammad is the prophet of the Quran, which is the holy book of Islam, or at least it's the first and main holy book of Islam. The Quran, despite what you might think, is also based upon the Old and New Testaments. It takes as truth the stories of both and incorporates them into its theology. I think one of the great sins of American education is that no one actually reads the Quran. No one knows what's in it. And I can tell you, having read part of it, that a good part of the beginning simply reiterates the same stories from the Old and New Testament. The Quran accepts Moses and Jesus as prophets. It names Muhammad as the next prophet. Now, just like the Old Testament and the New Testament, the Quran is a product of its time and place. It reflects the reality that was faced by the people at that time. If you ask a Muslim what the word Islam actually means, well, the most common translation I've been given is peace. Peace. And a Muslim practices Islam. A Muslim is a person of peace, someone who practices peace. Yeah. So just like Christianity is a religion of peace and love, there were nonetheless crusaders who committed bloody murderous atrocities all across Europe in the name of Christ. You can claim to have a religion of peace while others can use the same thing and twist it to very bloody ends. That, of course, is what is going on today. There are many ways to be a Jew. Secular Jews like me aren't even considered Jews by Orthodox Jews, because I don't follow any of the rules I'm supposed to follow. There are many ways to be a Christian. You can be Catholic and be very concerned with what the Pope and the Catholic Church has to say, or you can be Protestant and not really care about what the Pope has to say. You can care more about what your pastor says, what your minister says. There are many ways to be a Christian and many ways to practice Christianity. The same is true of Islam. There are many ways to be a Muslim and to follow Islam. Some are stricter or more orthodox than others. The version, the type of Islam that one practices is very heavily influenced by cultural factors. So Islam in parts of India looks very different from Islam in Afghanistan or Islam among black Muslims in the United States. There are many different ways to be Muslim. There are many different ways to interpret, to enact, to live by the Quran. Many different ways. Uniformly, every Muslim student with which I have ever engaged believes in Islam as a religion of peace, believes that it is upon the individual to practice, to own, to enact in their being Islam. It is not something that can be forced upon someone. You cannot force Islam upon someone, because if they practice it out of obligation or requirement, then it's not genuine and it gets them no points at all. The people we refer to as ISIS or Daesh in the Middle East claim to be Muslim, but their interpretation of Islam is extremely radical and involves, first and foremost, the murder of every Muslim who disagrees with them. If you pay attention to the news, if you really read it, what you discover is that their primary victims, the primary people that are murdered by the people of ISIS or Daesh, are other Muslims. And when there is an indiscriminate attack on a public place, do you not assume that there might be Muslims there too who might die? But since they do not belong to the group, since they do not belong to Daesh, they are not Muslim enough, and therefore they deserve to die along with all of the so-called infidels. Any Muslim that you speak to, any American Muslim, any of my students will tell you these people are not practicing Islam. They are exploiting it for their own purposes, just the way the Knights of the Crusades exploited Christianity for their purposes. We as Americans have nothing to fear from Islam any more than we have to fear from Christianity or Judaism. These are three religions about the same God, about the same patriarch. They're all Abrahamic religions. They are all stacked one on top of the next, Christianity upon Judaism and Islam upon both. There is nothing in the Quran that is any more violent than anything in either the Old or the New Testament. Absolutely not. And all of the stories that are told make sense for the time in which these things happened. So let's talk about the veil. Let's talk about hijab. What's that about? Most Americans see a woman in a head covering, in a scarf, a veil or hijab, a burqa, and they think, oh, there goes a poor, oppressed woman. My student's presentation today absolutely tore that apart. So it turns out that veiling predates Islam. It's a pretty old practice from the Byzantine Empire, the Romans, the Greeks. Women used to do it as a sign of status. If you had enough money, if you had enough wealth to pay for the fabric to cover yourself in a veil, then obviously you were doing pretty good. I think among the Byzantines there was a law that even precluded prostitutes and slaves from wearing a veil, because it was like you were impersonating someone from the upper classes. So because veiling required quite a bit of fabric, it was a sign of status. It meant that you had the capital to get the fabric. It meant you were doing pretty well. It makes sense to veil, to have some kind of fabric to wrap around your face, of course, when you live in the Middle East, particularly because of the sun. Let's face it, these folks are fairly light-skinned, and the sun can be pretty strong in the Middle East. And then, of course, because of the sand, the dirt, all the stuff flying around in your face. Even the men's garment has something that you can pull up across your face to guard yourself from the sun or the dust. So hijab is actually very practical, considering the environment. It was only during the era of imperialism and colonialism, when countries like France started invading Muslim nations, and then they built up this whole narrative, they constructed this discourse that said that the veil was a sign of oppression. It was used as justification for the colonization of Muslim countries. We have to liberate these women from their horrible, oppressive veils and from the subjugation of Muslim men. That was the narrative. So this story, this discourse, is more than 100 years old, and now it's ridiculously out of date. The most populous Muslim nation in the world is actually Indonesia, and you really never hear anything about oppressed women in veils or burqas in Indonesia, so it's not a factor there. The place where women are forced to wear hijab are places that have a political history that explains why. So, for example, Iran was a pretty progressive place until we deposed their leader, replaced him with the Shah, and then so many years later provoked this Islamic revolution that resulted in the capture of American hostages. Anybody old enough to remember this? Spelled the end of Jimmy Carter's presidency. A group of ruling Islamic, extremist Islamic leaders rose to the top, the Ayatollahs, and they started controlling the government. It was a democracy, it became a theocracy. And all of a sudden, this country that had been, again, fairly secular, all of a sudden the women had to cover themselves, they had to wear hijab. this was dictated by the somewhat fundamentalist Ayatollahs who came to power in Iran. So you can read Persepolis, two graphic novels, or I think it was made into a film as well, stories by Marjane Satrapi. And she grew up during this revolutionary period and tells what it was like to be from a relatively secular family and then to have to wear the head covering. So there is a political history behind this. At any rate, the Muslims that we encounter in America are Americans. I mean, after you've been here for a while, you assimilate to a large degree. Maybe you don't, but your children certainly do. And American Muslims will tell you that they have to make a choice. They make a choice about whether or not to wear hijab. All of my female Muslim students, whether they believe that hijab is required by the Quran or not, it doesn't matter. They definitely believe that they have to take it upon themselves as an act of free will in order for it to have any meaning at all. I have had female students who were instructed to wear hijab by their parents, and then when they became adults around the age of 18 or so, they took off the head covering. They did it of their own free will. I had one student explain to me this was because she understood that if she was going to wear it, it had to come from her heart. She had to be doing it for the right reasons. She couldn't do it just because her parents wanted her to. It would be meaningless. So women in America who wear hijab, they do it out of free will. Again, if it's not free will, it's meaningless. It gets you no points. After the presentation was complete at the meeting, some of my students asked questions. And some of these questions ran to, well, what are the rules for how concealing your attire is? So what is it that makes some Muslim women wear just a headscarf and others cover a good part of their face and others wear a full body garment and others where you can't even see their eyes? And Khadija gave such a great answer. It actually was really enlightening for me. And she explained it as a measure of the depth of your devotion. How much are you willing to give up? How much are you willing to cover yourself up? The more complete the cover, the more devotion to God and to Islam. There is, of course, another really great advantage for young women in America, and I guess other places, of wearing hijab, of dressing modestly, of covering at least their hair, if not a good part of their face, and definitely obscuring their body shape. And the advantage is that men look at them as human beings, as intellects, as personalities, instead of as objects, instead of as bodies. And I have had many Muslim women tell me this, that when they wear hijab at school, the men they interact with see them as students. And then the women who try removing hijab report to me immediately that they can't stand all the men all over them, all up in their faces. So it is actually very liberating to be freed from what feminists and people who study women's studies call the male gaze. Think about it, women. Wouldn't it be cool to just not have to worry what you look like and just walk through the world relying on your wits and your personality? At any rate, the choice of whether or not to wear hijab must be made by each young woman. So the veil is not a tool of oppression. It is not a sign of oppression. That's just a story that the French told us when they colonized Algeria and Morocco. It's just a whole load of propaganda that was used to justify the subjugation of Muslim people. When you see a Muslim woman walking down the streets of any American town wearing hijab, you should really be pretty amazed at her bravery, because she's committed to following her faith despite the risk it may put her at. You're definitely not looking at an oppressed woman. Contrary to the insane suggestions of people like Donald Trump, the very worst thing that we can do as Americans is to turn against an entire group of people on the basis of their faith. To judge an entire group of people of faith on the basis of a slim minority who use that faith, who twist it to use it to their own ends, is irrational and unjust. Shall we condemn every Christian to the same fate on the basis of those who murder others in the name of Christ? No, of course not. We can't paint everyone with the same broad brush. every faith is vulnerable to use by extremists as a twisted justification for their actions. But that's all that it is. It is a twisted justification for their actions, which they typically take for reasons that have nothing to do with faith. Religious extremists like ISIS, Daesh, whatever you want to call them, are after the same thing that all extremists are after: land, money, power. It's the same thing that fuels every bloody conflict. It's no different this time. The religion is just a mask. We can't let ourselves be taken down by the ignorance of people like Trump, or rather, by the brilliance of people like Donald Trump, who know how to exploit the ignorance that is present in our American society. If you let him talk you into hating Muslims, then you are surrendering critical thought. You are allowing your mind to be controlled by someone else whose motivation has nothing to do with you. What is he after? Money. Power. Simple. This nation, by the way, was settled by religious extremists. Remember? Puritans. People who were chased out of England because of their extreme version of Christianity. America was actually settled from the outset as a haven for religious extremists. I mean, if you think about it, the Amish wound up here. They were referred to as Anabaptists because the Catholics said they were against baptism. They're not. The Amish just believe that it's adults who should be baptized and make an adult commitment to the church. But, you know, the Catholics thought this was totally wrong. They called them anti-Baptists or Anabaptists and excommunicated them and executed them and you name it. And they ran away and came to the United States and built their isolated communities where they continued to follow their fairly orthodox version of Christianity. We've got lots of interesting strains of Christianity in the United States, including the Mennonites and the Shakers and all these other folks. These folks, these people, they were extremists. They usually wound up here in the United States because they were chased out of Europe. Okay, so granted, this type of extremism does not involve violence and it's not really comparable, but you get the point. The United States has always been home to people with incredibly orthodox points of view, people who could best be described as fundamentalists. The members of ISIS and Daesh are not fundamentalists. Once again, they're just twisting Islam to their own ends. Like any faith, Islam will occasionally be exploited by people who are extremists. It does not characterize Islam as a faith, and it does not characterize Muslims as a whole. There are people who will tell you that the religion is a violent religion. They usually have not read the Quran. If they have read it, then they haven't read it with the same kind of critical distance that they perhaps have read the Bible. Because, as I said to you before, the Quran is no more violent than the Bible, particularly the Old Testament. Everyone who has a vision of Islam as a religion of violence is, guess what, not Muslim. And what do people who aren't Muslim know about Islam? Very little, if anything. So you should ask Muslims what Islam is about. They will happily tell you it is a religion of peace and that all of these extremists are not real Muslims. Go ahead, ask them. They will tell you. There are always going to be crazy people. There are always going to be murderous people. There are always going to be people who think that life after death, if such a thing exists, is infinitely better than actual life. And there is, I don't know if there is anything that we can do to stop these people from being bent on destruction of themselves and anyone else around them. These people will always find a way to justify their actions. Religion is convenient. People are miserable and unhappy with their lives, they feel oppressed, they feel hopeless, and they become attracted to extremist ideals which promise them a better afterlife. And once someone becomes convinced that death is better than life, you can almost certainly count on them to do some destruction on their way out if they also believe that it will get them to a better heaven to do so. People who believe they are going to a special kind of Muslim heaven for killing innocents are not real Muslims, because any real Muslim person will tell you that that person is condemned forever for killing innocent people. That is forbidden in the Quran. The people who accuse Islam of being a religion of violence are not themselves Muslim. How would they know? Do they bother talking to Muslims? No, I do. All the time. Every day. 14 years. Trust me, I know a little bit more than they do. So there you have it. A little bit of information about Islam that you might not otherwise have been provided with. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you got something out of it. If you have something to say, you can write to me, theanonymousanthropologist@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. Be interested to hear your questions, or if you have anything that you disagree with, love to hear what you have to say. Be happy to respond to you in the next podcast. I look forward to speaking with you again soon. In the meantime, take care.
Am I recording?